Last week, I began a series of sermons or Bible studies, and I gave the first one on the subject of food, and I think it's probably going to be a series of three Bible studies that I'll be giving on the subject of health generally, and entitled, I suppose, Caring for Our Physical Temple. Obviously, it's not our physical temple, it's the temple of God's Spirit. But it's the part of the physical temple over which we have jurisdiction. And certainly the subject of food is a major area, and therefore I thought that was something that would take a full Bible study on, and therefore dealt with that last week. Today, however, I want to continue with that subject, and I want to deal with three areas. And although I say three areas which are slightly unusual, I suppose, when I say air is one of them, environment is the other, and time is another, these are three areas that affect us physically. I mean, we live in air, and the air we breathe in every single minute of every single day, whether awake or asleep, and that air is then used up as well. And that is one area I want to deal with. Area. And secondly, the environment I wanted to go into. The environment around us affects us. Obviously, things like health and hygiene and bacteria and the cleanliness, that kind of thing is an important area that we need to deal with, and it has a bearing on us physically. And thirdly, time. That's what our life consists of. And then we'll go, and I've got three other areas that I want to deal with. Not next week. I think I'll probably give a different sermon next week because I'll be in Tennessee. But we'll then go back to this probably in 2 weeks, 3 weeks' time. Just there'll be another one when we come back here. We'll be going over to Bristol. And then after that, probably the Bible study down in Wales, which I'll give the final one in this particular series. So let's have a look at the subject of air. Turn over to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. And we can see that in the creation of man, not only was man formed of the dust of the ground, becoming a physical being, and this was his physical body. And without a physical body, our lives do not exist. I say physical body. Without a body, we do not have a life. Now, we either have a physical body, which we have now, or we're going to be given a spirit body in the future that gives us, allows us to, if you like, come back into being again. But here we see in verse 7 of Genesis chapter 2, it says, "The eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground. But he also, notice, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being, a living soul." And the word soul is nephesh. It means the same thing used for creature in the preceding verses. In the case of the preceding verses, certainly it means it's just an ordinary physical breathing creature. And that is what it means in the case of man as well. It's a breathing creature. That's what he became. But what was being breathed by man, and certainly by all the other animals as well, as we'll go and read a little bit more, is this living breath. And this living breath we're breathing all the time. Little Isabel over there is fast asleep, hopefully through the service. But she's breathing, and she has to, all of us, right the way through as we sleep. We've still got to breathe to keep alive, because that oxygen is going into our body and has to continue to go into the body, and then the carbon dioxide being exhaled as well. So this air, it's a continual process. It's coming in, it's going out. Now, everybody knows this. Everybody understands that. But when we're looking at our physical health, we tend to forget it, because we feel that we can sit in front of a computer all day, and our breathing can be shallow, and then we can go to bed at night, then we can get up and sit in front of a computer all day, and our life will just remain static. It doesn't. It's got to actually start, as it says here, it says a breath of life, or the living breath is what it's talking about. If we go over to Genesis chapter 9, where it's talking about to Noah, this is also a verse I think I read last week, but here in Genesis 9 verse 4 it says, "Flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat." In other words, you don't eat the blood the blood which is in, within the flesh. And that was implemented as far as Noah was concerned. And it is, when it says with the life thereof, the word life is nephesh, it's soul. So the flesh with the soul, the living creature in it, the thing that gives the life, then it says that you shouldn't eat it. And that they say, is in the blood. That's being said here, that's in the blood. And if you turn over to Leviticus chapter 3, Leviticus chapter 3, we find a scripture here in Leviticus chapter 3, which also deals with this particular subject. And it links two things together in this particular verse, where it says, it'll be in verse 17, it says, it'll be a perpetual statute for you, for your generations, throughout all your dwellings, that you eat neither fat nor blood. Now the context of this passage, if you go through the rest of chapter 3 and read it, it's talking about animal fat. And when I say animal fat, I do not mean butter. I mean animal fat as in the animal fat as it talks about around the kidneys, which is the suet. If you ever open an animal up, the fat that is around the kidneys after the animal has got cold is a crumbly fat. It is suet. And it's a different type of fat. But it's mentioning that kind of fat and the other fat that is within the animal. We should trim the fat off to the best of our ability. We shouldn't eat it. And it also mentions blood here. And it ties back to what we just read over in Genesis 9, verse 4, about the life, the nephesh, being in the blood. And we've just read about man becoming a living nephesh, and talking about air. And what basically happens is that the air that we breathe in goes into our blood, and then goes around our bodies, and nourishes the muscles, and the muscles then use it, and out it goes again. Now, as I say, the problem is, if that becomes sluggish, then we have problems with our health. And this is an area, and it's not just a case of exercise. I mean, exercise is one way, but there are other ways as well, that get the blood moving, that get the air moving. And it's not even just a case of the breathing heavily. I mean, you can I could sit here behind a desk and breathe very heavily and get lightheaded. That's not sufficient. It's got to be used. And when you look at the analogy that's been given with the Spirit of God, how the Spirit actually comes into us and then is used, and then it isn't a static thing. It's a living thing. It's something that comes into us and then must be used, must go out of us as well. And this the same way, the principle is the same way as far as the blood is concerned. So here in Leviticus, if we stay in Leviticus a little while, let's just go over to Leviticus 17 and look at another verse here. Leviticus 17. And here in verse 11 it says, for the life, the nephesh, this living soul that man became, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. Notice, the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your nephesh, for your souls. Now this is the picture of Christ's blood, where the spear went into Christ. His blood came out. His nephesh came out symbolically. And that was the end of the Christ as a human being. And the only way he then was able to live again was to have a new body. And this is the type that has been given to us. We're not an immortal mortal soul. We're not an immortal nephesh. The nephesh is tied to the body. Be that body physical, be that body spirit. But it's tied to the body. And the life of this nephesh that we've got now is in the blood. And it's tied to the air, the living breath. So this is Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11. For the life of the nephesh of the flesh is in the blood, and I've given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls. It's the blood that makes an atonement for your nephesh, for your living, breathing creature. Therefore I said unto the children of Israel, no nephesh of you, no living creature of you, shall eat blood, neither shall a stranger that sojourns among you eat blood. Now, if I just mention a little bit about, or I meant to mention about Leviticus 3, it mentioned there you shall not eat fat or blood. The context of the fat there was the fat of animals. It's not the fat of chickens, it's not the fat of fish. not fish oils. So the fat of fish oil and even the fat of chicken, it doesn't, if you go through all the instances about fat, it is not, the context isn't, does not include that. But the fat of animals, then yes, we should not be eating that. And there is, it's a polyunsaturated fats, whereas in the case of chickens, it's not. And certainly not butter. As I mentioned last week, where you've got organic milk, there are actually polyunsaturates within the organic milk. You shall eat neither blood, no soul of you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger that sojourns among you eat blood. And whoever, whichever man there be that is the children of Israel, or the strangers that sojourn among you, which hunts and catches any beast or fowl that may be eaten, he will even pour the blood thereof out and cover it with dust. For it is the life, the nephesh, of all flesh. The life of all flesh, that's animal and us as well. All flesh is in the blood. All physical flesh, that's where our life is. That's where the breathing creature is. Without that breathing creature, we would cease to be. And we will only come back into being if we had a body which is breathing. Now, in the case of a spirit body, it has to breathe spirit, presumably. But whatever it is, this is the analogy that has been given to us. For it is the life, the nephesh of all flesh. The blood of it is for the life thereof, the nephesh thereof. Therefore I said to your children of Israel, you shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh. For the life, or the nephesh of all flesh, is the blood thereof. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. So it's talking specifically there. But our life is tied to the blood. It's tied to the air that's going into our lungs. And that, just as much as the food that goes into our mouth, it is something that we need to be aware of and something that we need to take note of, particularly in our sedentary way of life. Now, one example that Mr. Armstrong used to give, that he used to follow, and I remember Mr. Ted Armstrong, his son, commenting about this particular example. And that is that he said that he'd read somewhere about longevity, Mr. Herbert Armstrong now, read about longevity, and in this particular article or whatever else he was reading, this was quite some time ago, whether he was probably in his early 20s, that it talked about how they analysed all the kind of habits of various people. You know, some smoked, some didn't smoke, some ate this, some didn't eat that, and so on. And the only thing that they could come up with, that every single one of the people who lived to be, 90, 100, whatever it was, whatever the cut-off point was a brisk daily rub down with a towel. And Mr. Armstrong himself used to actually meticulously follow this. And Mr. Ted Armstrong said, you know, he'd see him come out of a shower, and he'd rub himself down until he was red all over, basically, and massage his body, basically, to bring get the blood moving, to start stimulating the blood so that this blood would move. So this kind of scripture, again, you would read this kind of scripture, and the life, our physical life, is tied to our blood. It's tied to our blood, it's tied to getting that blood moving, it's tied to getting the air going in and out of our lungs, and that is the life, our physical life. It's not just for food. You know, you can go ahead and you can eat all the kind of right food, but if the blood's not moving, if we're sedentary, we're sitting down in a desk all the time, and incidentally, with this new business of thrombosis, and we were going on a long haul flight tomorrow. We'll be flying across the States, all being well, and there's this deep vein thrombosis problem that they've highlighted on these long haul flights. But they also did analysis of people that actually sat on long haul flights and people sitting behind a desk. They're identical. So sitting behind a desk is also a danger. We should be getting up and moving around so that our blood actually moves around. The problem with things like atrial fibrillation, where you have the heart missing a beat, and you get this atrial problem, the atrium being the chambers of the heart, The problem is that if the heart doesn't squeeze that blood out, there remain pockets, apparently, within the chambers that clots can then start to form, the same as you get thrombosis in the legs. It's because it's not pumping properly, it's not moving the blood around, and the clots then start to form. Again, if you cut yourself, you think about the blood, and you think about how that blood comes out, and it's quite an amazing sequence where the calcium ion from the breakup of the cell stimulates, what is it, thrombin and prothrombin? I think it's prothrombin first, and then it goes to fibrin, goes to fibrinogen. There's a three-phase reaction that takes place to form the scab. Now, you've got to have that scab formed when the calcium ions are there, when it breaks the surface, otherwise you bleed to death. But in the blood, actually within the arteries and the veins, it must not form. And therefore, you know, talk about being fearfully and wonderfully made. We truly are. Truly are. To get fibrin to seal the wound so fast as it does when the wound we get cut. And yet at the same time, we do not get clots within our bodies normally. But that body has got to be kept in a certain way. It's got to be have this movement. It's got to get this, you know, it's a living body and it's been made to live. It's been made to move, not sit on our backsides all the time. And in our modern world, with our cars and with our computers and with our long-haul flights and everything else that we've got, we have a problem in our modern world. We really do. That's therefore, the subject of air is very important. And when you also then put it into context with the fact that, well, let's just turn over to John chapter 20. John chapter 20. In John chapter 20, we see how Christ ties in this air that's breathing in his body with the very Spirit of God. Now here you're actually finding that the disciples are within, you know, they're in the room in round about verse 19. That's John 20 verse 19. And they were in the room, and he suddenly appeared and said shalom to them and scared them half to death. And he then, verse 20, he said, he showed them his hands, his side, and the disciples were glad. And he was a physical human being by all accounts. But it then said Jesus to them, peace be unto you, as my Father has sent me, even so I send you. Verse 22, and when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, receive the holy breath, the holy breath. And the equation is between the breathing, which he did at that time, and the holy breath, the Holy Spirit. You're looking this the two are equated together. Now, when we understand that Spirit has got to be used, and we look at it in the way of our physical bodies, I know that one time I had atrial problems. I had atrial fibrillation, and it was I did some research into it, and I saw certain doctors to get advice on it. And the problem basically was overbreathing. It was hyperventilation. And what happens if you hyperventilate, in other words, you breathe too much when you're not actually using the breath, in other words, you're under stress, and you therefore just sit and stew, and you breathe, then what happens is the body chemistry, the actual blood chemistry, starts to change. And that then triggers all kinds of different reactions within the body from the pH levels that have changed within the blood. The way in which to get rid of stress is to get out there and work physically, is to get out there and do something which then allows you to breathe, which is a natural kind of fight and flight reaction, and yet works, uses the oxygen that is in the body so that you've then got masses of carbon dioxide that you've then got to excrete through the lungs. And it's the over-excretion of carbon dioxide that changes the pH, makes it less acidic, which then triggers things like atrial fibrillation, where your heart starts missing beats, even blackouts, and a whole host of kidney problems, there's a whole host of things. And again, it's the stress levels that are not being used, the stress is not being used up, it hasn't got something that's being used up. Now, this is something that has never really been a problem to any major degree. Turn back to Genesis 18. Genesis 18. We look at some of the Old Testament examples we find that the lifestyle that they actually lived in Old Testament times and in New Testament times as well was an active lifestyle. And it's certainly, when you look at Abraham, for instance, in Genesis 18, verse 1, it says, the Eternal appeared to him in the plains of Mamre as he sat in the tent door at the heat of the day. Now, he was 99 years old. Now, here was a man 99 years old. And it says here, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door, bowed himself to the ground. No arthritis. Presumably he bowed to the ground, and he also ran. He was fit. He must have run before. And in verse 7, notice, it said, and Abraham ran to the herd and fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it to a young man, and he hastened to dress it. So he ran there. I mean, have you ever handled a calf, presumably, what, about a year old, something like that? You know, you've got to drag it out, and you've got to then whether he did he say gave it to a young man to be for him to dress. So anyway, but he ran. He wasn't just sitting there by any means. He was 99 years old when Isaac was born. He then saddled his ass. He got on his ass and he journeyed 3 days. And again, there's physical activity and physical. It wasn't like sitting in an aeroplane or sitting in a car. People go horse riding for exercise, and these people were doing this. Turn over to 1 Kings 18. Here is a real classic in 1 Kings chapter 18, when we see the amount of exercise some of the men of God actually got. And this particular one, as I say, is quite a classic one that we can turn to. 1 Kings chapter 18, this is the case of Elijah, when in verse 38, the fire of the Eternal fell and consumed the sacrifice. So here was the prophets of Baal, and it just licked everything up. And all the people, when they saw it, fell on their face, and they said, Elijah, Elijah, the Eternal is the God, in other words, which is what Elijah means. And Elijah said to them, take the prophets of Baal, and he went and slew them. And verse 41, and Elijah said to Ahab, get up, eat and drink, and there was a sacrifice, presumably, for there is the sound of an abundance of rain. So Abraham went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and he cast himself down to the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, look, go up and look towards the sea. So he went up and he went 7 times, and it came to pass at the 7th time, verse 44, he said, look, there arises a little cloud out of the sea. And he said, go up and tell Ahab, prepare your chariot and get you down that the rain doesn't stop you. So here was Ahab in a chariot, and he had to say, look, get going because it's about to stop you. And it came to pass in the meanwhile that the heaven was black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. So he was in a chariot with how many horses, a couple of horses or whatever in front of him, riding to Jezreel. And the hand of the Eternal was on Elijah, and he girded his loins, and he ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. So the indication is that he beat him. Now, presumably he went over the top of Carmel, or over the took a shortcut or whatever, but he beat the horse and chariots, as he ran. Now, this was a man of God, and he was somebody, as I say, exercise was not a problem at that time. It just wasn't. And if we look at, even in the New Testament, or in Acts chapter 8, we also find another example here, that in the New Testament also, it wasn't a problem for people to run, they didn't have to think, I wonder if I'm going to drop down dead. But in Acts chapter 8, now verse 26, we pick it up there. The angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, arise and go towards the south and to the way that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza, which is desert. And he rose and he went, and behold, a man of Ethiopia, a eunuch of great authority under Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. And he said, verse 28, he was returning and sitting in his chariot to read Isaiah the prophet. So here again is a chariot going through. He's sitting, it's probably some kind of carriage, this particular one. And the Spirit said to Philip, go near and join yourself to this chariot. Join yourself to this carriage. And Philip ran there to him, and he could hear him reading the prophet Isaiah. And he said, do you understand what you're reading? So here's this carriage going along the road, driven, pulled by horses. Philip, one of the apostles, runs after it, catches up, runs alongside, and talks to the man inside the carriage. He's fit. And it wasn't a big deal. It was just the kind of, well, it's what you do. I mean, Shank's pony was the means of getting around. And you can see that very, very clearly as far as Shank's pony, which is obviously two legs. Turn over to Luke 13. Luke 13. And yet in our modern world, this isn't the case. In our modern world, unfortunately, we are laying up in store health problems for ourselves. Because why? Because the air, which is the breath of life, is not moving through our bodies in the way that it was designed to, through the blood. The blood has got to move. You look at children, naturally. Can you keep them still? You can keep them still for that brief period of time when they're fast asleep, most of the time anyway. But you know, if you look over in Luke chapter 13, Luke 13, verse 22, and it says, he went through the cities and the villages, teaching and journeying towards Jerusalem. Now this is Christ, in human form, completely human, human being. And here he is walking through, and it's very clear that he was walking. He wasn't journeying by carriage or chariot or horseback or anything else. He was walking. Verse 33, you can also see the same thing here. He says, nevertheless, I must walk today and tomorrow and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet perishes out of Jerusalem. So he's walking around the area, teaching, and he said, right, 3 days, I'm going to walk down to Jerusalem itself. And the way that they walked at that particular time, as I understand it, I remember Jerusalem's 3,500 feet up in the air. The way they would walk would be, as I understood it, they'd walk down the valley of the Jordan towards Jericho, and from Jericho up to Jerusalem. So you're going, actually, you're coming down from Galilee, you descend, Galilee is just below sea level, but you then descend to 1,000 feet below sea level, down to Jericho, and then you ascend 1,000 feet, plus another 3,500 feet up to the top. And that's the way Christ, again, it was just taken for granted. That this is what you do. This is how it worked, and this is what Christ did. I mean, what actually happened as far as he was concerned? I mean, he went into a mountain to pray. You find examples of that about Christ. How did he get into mountains to pray? You know, the disabled did not have these disabled stickers, therefore you can go ahead and have your scenic railway to pull you up to the top of the mountain. You got on Shank's pony and you walked up there. And he walked, and they probably were rutty. It was hardly probably a footpath as such. He'd just walk across the fields, up into a mountain, into a wilderness, a desolate area, and he would be able to therefore pray. But another example that you can look at, if you go onto the website and look at the co-worker letters, I think they're certainly on Get Back on Track. There's several sections, but certainly Get Back on Track, I'm not sure. They're probably actually on the COGIW. There's also a copy. But around the time of his wife's illness, now, no, they're not on Get Back on Track. Ah, where are they? Anyway, I'll see if I can post it sometime. But around about the time of his wife's illness, which is about 1967, the early part of 1967, in a co-worker letter there, which I meant to print out and I never did, Mr. Armstrong talked about how he was having certain health problems, and he decided he needed more exercise, and he was walking 4 times a day. He would get out and he would walk, I think it's for 30 minutes each time, because he realized that he had to do this. You know, he could not cope with what he was going through at the time under normal conditions. He had to get the exercise to get the blood moving again. And he was having health problems, and he was under enormous amounts of stress with his wife being ill. And yet, this is what he did. This is how he coped with this particular problem. I mean, you look at the things like the space missions, where you have the Skylab and that kind of thing. The big problem was bone loss. that when these astronauts came back, they found that the bone densities were had markedly changed. We need to have exercise. We need to have, if you like, pressure against the joints, against the bones, to then, which then actually gives a great deal more strength to those bones. It actually increases the amount of calcium within the bones. So, you know, it is a very important aspect. We were meant to be active. And if we are active, it's also very helpful, this breath of life, this living air, which then circulates around our body within our blood. It's necessary, if we can, to make sure that is fresh air. It's out in the sunshine. It's out in the fresh air. It's not the kind of smoky environments as far as cigarette smoke, which is passive smoking, which is in the news these days. And it's also not the exhausts from the various cars and lorries. And that's not what we're supposed to be breathing in. When we come into the second area that I want to deal with today, which is environment, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Here in, yes, I wouldn't mind a drink, thank you. Deuteronomy chapter 4, if you notice what it says in verse 1, it says, "Now therefore listen, O Israel, into the statutes and to the judgments which I teach you, to do them, that you may live and go and possess the land which the eternal God of your fathers gives you. You will not add to the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish anything from it, that you may keep the commandments of the eternal your God that I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Eternal did because of Baal Peor. And for all the men that followed Baal Peor, the Eternal your God has destroyed them from among you." Now, so here God is talking about the statutes and the judgments. In verse 5, "I've taught you the statutes and judgments, even as the Eternal my God commanded me." That's Moses telling them. "So keep, therefore, and do them." And as it says there, it says, "For this is your wisdom." This is your wisdom. Now, there's an awful lot of wisdom within Scripture which in preceding generations was not understood. This generation that we're in now has a certain degree of understanding in certain areas of hygiene, of the environment that we should have, the kind of environment that is promoting health and the kind of environment that is not. But it's interesting that Moses is saying here, or God is saying through Moses, that this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations which shall hear of all the statutes, and say, surely this great nation is a wise and an understanding people, because the wisdom is coming from God. It's a certain degree of wisdom that simply was not in the nations round about. It says, "For what nation is there so great that has God so near to them, as the eternal God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day?" And he says, particularly take notice of the Ten Commandments. But he also talks about the statutes and the judgments as well. Now there's one lady who was asked, what's the secret of England's greatness? And that was Queen Victoria. And this was asked by a prince from the continent of India, who came round and had an audience before the Queen, one of the whatever they're called over the Indian, the Raj, wasn't it? The Raj. It was the British Raj, but there's also the Indian Raj, and they were the Raj princes. But anyway, they asked, what was the secret of England's greatness? And Queen Victoria sent for a Bible, and there's actually a famous painting over in Portrait Gallery, I think it is, in the London. And within that painting, it's actually depicting this particular incident. And she showed this prince the Bible. Because a lot of what we actually had at that time that was being implemented within the reign of Queen Victoria, the principles were being found from Scripture. And particularly the principles of hygiene were being implemented at that time, which really transformed the entire nation, and certainly the capital, London. If you turn over to Hebrews 9, just as a little precursor, however, just before we go into these various scriptures and bits and pieces in this area of environment, just remember this scripture over in Hebrews chapter 9. The way we apply these things today is not the same way as they applied them in Old Testament times. As it says here in Hebrews chapter 9, it says, the Holy Spirit, verse 8, thus signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, and we were not visible, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing, which is a figure of the time then present, in which were both offered gifts and sacrifices that couldn't make him that did the service perfect, as pertaining to the conscience, which stood only in meats, that's meat offerings, and drinks, that's drink offerings, and different washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation. Now, it is the application of the spirit of the law. Now, that does not mean to say that we do away with things like holy days, Sabbaths, or anything like that. But we do need to make sure that we look at the things that we are reading, and we really need to understand that many of these washings and ordinances, in a purely ritualistic sense, are not required today. But the washings and ordinances, the principles and the mindset behind those principles are. And there is your wisdom. There is the wisdom of the statutes and judgments, that when we apply these principles, we are in fact protected. And certainly in our environment, we have a great deal of protection. If I can read a little bit from a book called The Healthy Body and Victorian Culture by a man called Bruce Haley. And he brings out that in 1831, between 1831 and 1842, that's just over 10 years, he said the first outbreak of Asiatic cholera in Britain was at Sunderland in the Durham coast during the autumn of 1831. From there, the disease made its way northward into Scotland and southwards towards London. Before it had run its course, now this is Asiatic cholera, before it had run its course, it had claimed 52,000 lives. Now, cholera is a waterborne disease. And it's because the water supply was dirty, let's put it quite bluntly, was contaminated by fecal matter. That's why you get cholera. And I know that in Nigeria, there is still this problem. And it is because you have sanitation. I mean, I look at Nigerian streets and I see the blocked drains and I see the filth that is around in the rubbish piles. And I see it rain and flood and the whole lot mixes together. And then it gets down into the wells. There's no wonder you've got typhoid down there. And you have this real problem. But you see, within God's law, that should not be. Things need to be organized. They need to be clean, as we'll go on and see. It is the fact that we should be clean, and God is clean. And the environment also, by implication, should also be clean. We need to look at our environments to make sure that that is the case. And certainly you in Nigeria, you need to realize that the environment that you're in is anything but. Now, we are overly sanitized here in the West in many ways. We do not have exposure to natural bacteria, which are in milk, milk is a living substance. We do not have anything but pasteurized cheeses, which is ridiculous, because the unpasteurized cheeses allow the bacteria to also have a natural presence within our guts. But there are problems, you see, when you start feeding animals on the rubbish that they feed them on, then they've got to go ahead and pasteurize it because the animals get sick and therefore the bacteria present are of the wrong kind. It's a vicious... All these areas that we're dealing with are linked together to give a... it's a holistic way, really, to health, which is what God's way is. All these areas have an impact, whether it's exercise and the air and making sure the blood moves around our body, whether it's the food that we put in our mouths, whether it's the environment that is surrounding us. They all have a bearing. But it says here this Asiatic cholera had claimed 52,000 lives in less than 10 years.
Or just like, you know, over 10 years. Did you ask? It says, for this point of origin of Bengal, it had taken 5 years across Europe, so that when it reached the course of Durham, British doctors were well aware of the nature, but not its cause. In other words, within this early reign of Queen Victoria, they didn't understand cholera. They didn't realise what the reason for cholera was. But cholera is spread by contaminated water. Another area that I'm mentioning in this book, it says that in the 1830s, the new fever called typhus was isolated. Now, typhus is spread by lice, as far as I understand. Again, it's to do with cleanliness. During its worst outbreak in 1837, it says, most of the deaths from fever in London were attributed to typhus, and a new case averaged about 16,000 in England in each of the next 4 years. So that's 16,000 cases every year for the next 4 years. It also coincided with one of the worst smallpox contagions, which killed tens of thousands of infants and children. The same year, 1846, it says, as the potato famine struck Ireland, a virulent form of typhus appeared, cutting down large numbers of even well-to-do families. As Irish workers moved from cities like Liverpool and Glasgow, the Irish fever, in quotes, moved with them. And by 1847, the contagion, not all of it connected with immigration, had spread throughout England and Wales, accounting for over 30,000 deaths from typhus. Another quote from this book, it says, in his report on the sanitary conditions of the labouring population of Great Britain, Edwin Chadwick included figures to show that in 1839, for every person who died, this is a stunning statistic, for every person who died of old age or violence, so it's a natural, not a natural and unnatural in that sense, both old age and violence, for everyone that died from old age or violence, 8 died of specific diseases. 8 died of disease for everyone that died of old age or violence. And this help explains why during the second and third decades of the 19th century, even 1 infant in 3 in England failed to reach the age of 5. Let's have a look. Yeah, it says, during the first decades of Victoria's reign, baths were virtually unknown in the poorer districts and uncommon anywhere else. So they just didn't have baths. It says, for the new middle-class homes in the growing manufacturing towns, elevated sites were usually chosen, with the result that sewage then filtered or flowed down to the lowest areas where the labouring population dwelt. So you're looking at, this is the way in which Victoria started her reign. And yet, as she also pointed out to that prince, that you look to that book. There is the secret of England's greatness. And part of it was the principles that were coming out of this Old Testament in the areas of hygiene that transformed the sewers, it transformed the water supply, and gave the sanitation that we have today. And in London, I mean, only now are they really trying to replace some of these sewers, which are the old Victorian sewers, put down by Queen Victoria's, well, people of Queen Victoria's time. Turn over to Deuteronomy 23, again, looking at the principles involved here. In Deuteronomy 23, in verse 9, it says, when the host, that's the army, goes forth against your enemies, then keep you from every wicked thing. If there's among you any man that's not clean by reason of uncleanness that chances him by night, then he should go abroad out of the camp and should not come within the camp. So presumably he's talking about nocturnal emissions, and they actually went outside the camp. And it said, but when evening comes, he shall wash himself with water, and when the sun is down, he will come into the camp again. And you'll find this continually, that it will be in the evening you're able to then be cleaned. In other words, you come into the new day, when the sun goes down, then you're cleaned, and you wash yourself beforehand. And you'll find that you also wash clothes, you also wash vessels, and then you wait until the evening, and then they are clean. And we'll come on to that a little bit later. It says, then you shall have a place also outside the camp where you'll go forth abroad, and you'll have a paddle on your weapon, and it shall be that when you will ease yourself abroad, that you'll dig therewith, and turn back and cover that which comes from you. It's quite plain language. For the Eternal your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give you your enemies before you. Therefore shall your camp be holy. And the word holy carries a connotation of being clean. Holy and cleanliness is, you know, cleanliness is net to godliness. Well, the word holy means clean to a large degree. That he doesn't seize no unclean thing in you and turn away from you. Now, they understood, you know, that that aspect about holiness and cleanliness, and the implementation of that, even though they didn't understand about microbes, they didn't have the knowledge of that, nevertheless, this holiness and cleanliness was there. And you know, what about us as the people of God? What about things like nappies? Nappies are potential problems. You know, you, obviously you're not going to go and have a place outside abroad and a paddle on your whatever and go and bury your nappy out there. I'm not talking about that. But they've got to be handled carefully. They should not be contaminating. You know, you wash your hands, you use soap and water, and you are careful in that area. Because this is, you know, this is a principle that you find here within the very law of God. Turn back to Leviticus 11. Leviticus 11. Again, an area here, when you're looking at environment, and particularly our children, we need to be aware of what it says here. Leviticus 11, notice regarding clean and unclean meats, we always think of Leviticus 11. Verse 43, you will not make yourself abominable with any creeping thing that creeps, neither shall you make yourself unclean with them, that you should be defiled thereby. For I am the Eternal your God, you shall therefore sanctify yourself, that means clean yourself, Leviticus 11, verse 44. And you will be holy, clean, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourself with any manner of creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. For I am the Eternal that brings you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. And the word holy and clean is a synonymous word. This is the law of beasts and of fowl and of every living creature that moves on the water and every creature that creeps on the earth, to make a difference between the unclean and the clean, between the beast that may be eaten and the beast that may not be eaten. So it is to teach us the difference between clean and unclean, holy and unholy. And again, you look at Malachi, we don't need to turn there, we're going to stay here in Leviticus, but we have to make a difference between things that are spiritually clean and things that are spiritually unclean, between the wicked and the unrighteous, and the wicked and the righteous, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. And this is what we're learning spiritually. We learn also by learning physically, that we make a difference and a distinction between things that are clean and things that are not. And I want you to notice what it says here. We turn back in Leviticus 11, stay there, but back at verse 8. Notice what it says. It says, of their flesh shall you not eat, of their carcasses shall you not touch, they are unclean to you. Now it's just been talking about pig. So it does make you wonder, you know, why not touch it? Now, does that mean we must never touch pig? Again, where do we draw the line regarding a principle and a law of God? Well, I'm not going to answer that. I'm going to try and answer that one on this score. But I am going to point it out to you that look what it actually says here. And it's not something that we just treat lightly. We shouldn't be going ahead and allowing the carcasses being constantly in contact with us in that regard. Mind you, you must understand that it's talking about a dead carcass. It's not talking about skins. So you see, because you've got seal skin. You've got badger skin, which made part of the very temple itself. So there's a distinction there. You're talking about, you know, rotting carcasses, presumably. But, you know, you've got to be careful you're not defiled by a rotting carcass of an unclean animal, particularly. Because that will defile us. And perhaps if we go on a little bit further, notice verse 11. It says, they shall be even as an abomination to you. You shall not eat their flesh, but you shall have their carcasses in abomination. These are things like, you know, shrimps and prawns and that kind of stuff, and, you know, dead crayfish and all this kind of stuff. Slugs and snails and puppy dog tails as well, yeah. Whatsoever has not fins or scales in the water shall be an abomination, shall be abhorrent to us. It's not just the eating of it. And these are they which shall you will have in abomination among the fowl. They will not be eaten. They are an abomination, the eagle, the ossifrage, and the osprey. And again, you know, we need to be careful. When our kids go and find some dead body somewhere of some exotic creature and they bring it home, you know, you need to be careful, because it does say, this is part of the law of God. You've got to be very careful about this kind of thing. Verse 24, for these you shall be unclean. Whoever touches the carcass of them shall be unclean to the even, talking about these locusts and so on, other creeping flying things, your dead flies. Again, you go squash a fly on the window or whatever, clean it up, get it, you know, don't just necessarily leave it there. And for those you shall be unclean. Whoever touches the carcass of them shall be unclean till the even. And whoever bears any of the carcasses of them shall wash his clothes and be unclean till the even. The carcass of any beast that divides the hoof and not cloven foot and so on. And whoever goes among his paws, and it talks about any touching their carcass, shall be unclean till the even. Notice where it says washing his clothes and be unclean till the even. Now, there is a principle, again, that you find within places like farming areas where you've got to clean utensils for milk. First of all, you rinse them out with cold water, which gets rid of the fat within the milk, and you thoroughly rinse it with cold water. Then you have scalding hot water, which then is used with some kind of detergent, which then removes the remaining amount of fat. And then you rinse it with scalding hot water, and then you air dry it. That is the way in which you clean milk utensils. And that is the cleanest way of doing it. Again, cloths that you use for dishcloths, if you can air dry them, and certainly if you put them outside as well, when they're blowing in the wind and they've also got sunlight on them, which destroys bacteria, and also turns the drying of them turns the bacteria into a different form. It turns them into a cyst form, so that it removes the bacteria entirely from the actual garment. This is why, you know, you're looking at here in a desert area, you'd wash, you'd remain unclean till the even, and the thing would dry off, change all bacteria into the cyst form, and there you would have, therefore, something which is clean. And this is the law of God. We've got to take these principles and we've got to apply them to our day to day. The same basic principles apply. And where we can, certainly air drying is a means of cleanliness. It certainly is. Notice in verse 31, these are unclean to you amongst anything that creep. Whoever does touch them when they're dead shall be unclean to the even. Upon whatever of them when they are dead falls, it will be unclean, whether it's a vessel of wood or raiment or skin or sack, whatever vessel, any kind of work is done, it must be put in water, and it will be unclean till the even, and then it will be cleansed. So you put it in water, you wash it off, you then leave it air dry, and then it's clean by the time the even comes. And every earthen vessel whereon any one of them falls, whatever it is that shall be unclean, and you shall break it. In other words, if it's an earthen vessel where they can actually get into the paw, then you, in other words, you've got a dead mouse in there, and it's in a kind of like a plant pot type of clay pot, you need to break it, you need to get rid of it completely, because you cannot get rid of it out of the very paws itself. Of all food that may be eaten on which the water comes shall be unclean, and all drink that may be drunk in any such vessel shall be unclean. Remember what it talks about in Haggai, if you carry a skirt of something in your garment and you touch a dead body, shall it be clean or shall it not be clean? And these all tie in there. And every part, the thing that on any part of their carcass falls will be unclean, or ovens or ranges or pots, they'll be broken down, for they're unclean, and they shall be unclean to you. Nevertheless, a fountain or a pit where there's plenty of water shall be clean, but that which touches their carcass shall be unclean. So, in other words, you get rid of the carcass, you scrub down thoroughly the area wherever the carcass has touched. But if there's a fountain and the water's continually coming, then the water that's continually coming then eventually will be clean again. But again, notice this principle of air drying. of applying this principle. And notice it goes on, it even goes into if any part of their carcass fall upon any sowing corn, which is to be sown, it will be clean. Any water be put on the seed, then it will be unclean. And in verse 39, if any beast of which you may eat dies, no, it dies by itself, he that touches the carcass thereof will be unclean to the even. And he that eats the carcass will wash his clothes and be unclean to the even. And he that bears the carcass of it shall wash his clothes and be unclean to the even. So if we have a cow, say, die of, you know, whatever cause, we need to go ahead and wash our clothes, wash our hands, thoroughly clean up, and allow those clothes to air dry, and our, you know, bodies to dry, and then we become clean again. These principles certainly are principles that we can apply at this present time. This principle of air drying is certainly one that we can apply. I mean, even in areas like hospitals today, I was just talking to somebody the other day, and he mentioned that in ordinary hospitals, they have a ratio anything from about 4-1 up to about 6-1. In the current hospitals in the UK, the ratio of beds to wash hand basins, because they're trying to cope with this MRSA problem. So 6-1 is a common ratio between wash hand basins and the number of beds, 6 beds to 1 wash hand basin. In the hospital that has actually basically stopped MRSA within the country, the ratio is 1.5-1. So in other words, it shows that the washing of hands consistently is what is putting this particular disease back into its place, which is something that they've discovered over in Victorian times. And yet today, you know, what they do have is a problem. 5 years ago, anybody in a green theatre coat had to stay within the theatre, the operating theatre. But because of smoking policies, they now go out of the ward, out of the theatre, across the ward, go to the designated smoking area, have a puff of the fag, and then go back in again. And this, of course, is producing contamination back. And one thing I did notice down in Nigeria, which astounded me, is the nurses. You go outside a hospital, and you find the nurses in their white uniforms walking around the streets, and the streets are filthy. And I was horrified at that, because that is therefore bringing that back into the ward again. The epidioscopes, the things that people get shoved down their throats to endoscope, is it not epidioscope? Endoscopes, put down the throat or various other orifices to have a look at whatever, and they assure me that they use 2 different endoscopes for the. I'll just put the endoscope. There we go. I thought it was epidioscope for some reason. Okay. But in the UK, they try and clean these endoscopes using chemicals, which are super strong. And they use chemicals that if you spill a litre of it, you've got to go ahead and call the fire brigade to get the thing dealt with as a controlled spillage. But they were talking to another country, Finland, and they said, well, what do you do? I mean, how do you clean the endoscope? With soap and water. And they said, well, what about cross-contamination, cross-infection? There wasn't any. And so often, you know, if we properly use soap and water, you can control so many of the infections. The basic hygiene is a problem today. They seem to feel they want super chemicals to deal with it. You don't need that. Soap and water and air drying is the way in which you find within scripture, certainly water anyway, but they would probably have had soap as well. I mean, soap is quite easily used, manufactured. I mean, soap is made of burnt wood ash that has been had water leaks through it and then boiled up with fat, and therefore you make soap, sodium stearate. Another thing that we need to understand also is that unleavened bread teaches us about clutter, because in an environment that is cluttered, you're going to get problems. Another area as well, if you look over in 1 Timothy chapter 6, I'll tell you what, no, I won't turn there. I'll just simply refer to it. 1 Timothy 6:16 talks about God dwelling in the light that cannot be approached. In many cases, I've noticed that, again, I've noticed down in Nigeria, and I do understand that in Nigeria you do have, you know, you've got so much sunshine, you want to get away from it, and you also have a problem with mold there. But, you know, I do wonder whether, in fact, a light, airy place will keep your risk of disease down, because sunlight does kill bacteria. It does kill disease. And light and air, the blowing of air through, does cause, you know, it causes the actual the bacteria to change the form. It changes into a cyst form, which is the principle behind air drying. Another area as well, which I don't think I'm going to have time to go into, I'll just refer to the scriptures, 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16 to 17, and 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19 through 20. That's 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16 to 17, and 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19 to 20. Talks about the body being the temple of God's Spirit. And we've got to make sure that it says, you know, God will destroy him that destroys that temple. Now, one thing we do need to make sure is that we can do all this. We can have a super healthy body. We can eat good food. We can keep clean, all this, and then we can drive like maniacs on the road. We can end up smashed in some kind of car accident. And all the good work can be undone. Avoiding bodily injury is part of our responsibility, and it's all to do with this environment, the things around us. You know, you do not, you know, two objects do not occupy the same place. And therefore, if we break that law, and it's a living law, then all the other good, it's a holistic way of looking at things, all the other good will be of no value. We'll end up with a body that has been broken. Okay, moving into this final area, that's the area of time. We turn over to James chapter 4. We find in James 4 that James talks in verse 13, "Go to now, you that say today or tomorrow, we'll do go into such a city and continue there a year, buying and selling it gain, whereas you don't know what shall be the morrow. For what is your life?" Now we're looking at areas of our physical life. What is our life? And we've looked at the area of food, we've looked at the area of air, we've looked at the area of the environment around us and the impact that it has on us. But it says here, "For what's your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time, and then it vanishes away." Our life really is time. And that way in which we handle time impacts on our physical life. If we are chaotic and disorganized, it is going to, in the time area, it'll impact on our lives physically. As we'll go on and we'll deal with the mind and the mental things in the next Bible study, this area of time certainly has a great deal to influence the mental areas. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, this classic scripture where it talks about to everything there's a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven, Ecclesiastes 3 verse 1 and verse 2 now, it says a time to be born and a time to die. So often we find people struggling against this, you know, people struggle overly to try and put off the inevitable. Certainly in this world we see this continually, that people have no hope for the future whatsoever, so they put off until the very last gasp, and we have doctors going ahead and preserving life when really it is not necessary. In fact, it's not desirable. But it says there's a time to be born, yes, and there's a time to die, there's a time to plant, and there's a time to pluck up that's planted. A time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up. And over in verse 10, it says, "I've seen the travail, the work that God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it." He says, "He's given, made everything beautiful in his time. He's also set the world in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. And I know that there's no good in them, but the man should rejoice and to do good in his life." This life that is a vapor, this life that is a certain set time. And we can see, as it talking here, it says, and also that every man should eat and to drink and enjoy the good of all his labour. That's the gift of God. We do think this life that we have, the time that we're in, we should learn to enjoy each stage of our life. Be that stage being a child, and you know, don't rush a child through childhood. You know, let a baby be a baby. Let a child be a child. This impacts on their physical life and their development. Young marrieds, the indication from Scripture is that the young marriage should go ahead and enjoy that young married time. You know, this is why getting pregnant prior to marriage is so detrimental, because it doesn't allow that young married enjoyment, which is designed by God. And it basically is talking about all these areas of life, these various seasons of life, and making sure we enjoy that. Turn back to Genesis 2, and we find this in the creation of man. Certainly in Genesis 2 it says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, all the host of them, and the seventh day God ended his work which he'd made, and he rested the seventh day from the work that he'd made, and he blessed the seventh day and sanctified it." And here we are, we find ourselves on the Sabbath, and we do so because in it says here, he rested from all the work that God created and made. And we can see within this section of Scripture the way in which God used time, giving us an example. How, the evening morning was the first day, he did something specific. And then the evening morning was the second day, he did something specific. And he accomplished something on each day. That also gives us a sense of accomplishment. If we have a task to do, we need to break it down so that we have, you know, the various things, various areas that you need to do, such as wiring a house, which is what they've been doing here the last few days. But it needs to be broken down so that you can look back on the day and you can see a certain amount of accomplishment. It does help the physical, mental well-being, and our physical life is made up of time. And the way we use it is important. Then we come to the Sabbath and we rest on the Sabbath because it's been designed that way. In addition, notice in verse 14, here in Genesis 1, verse 14, it says, "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament for the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and seasons, and days, the years, that the light from the firmament of the heaven give light upon the earth. And it was so, and God made the two lights." So, God has set the signs, the seasons, the days, the years, the months. These are all been made by God and impact on our physical life. There are various rhythms that we have that we break at our peril. And I know that this next few days that we're going to be flying across the States, and we'll be having jet lag, but nothing probably like when we come back again from the States. You know, our bodies work on just slightly more than a 24-hour clock. And, you know, providing the sun rises at the same time each day, getting out in the open air, getting out in the light in the morning particularly, sets that rhythm, sets that that clock, that internal clock. And when you fly across the ocean, unfortunately, it does get out of kilter. In Leviticus 23, you find within the feast days also that the feasts were given in their seasons. Leviticus 23, the Eternal spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, say to them concerning the feast of the Eternal, which shall proclaim holy convocations. These are my feasts." And it says, verse 4, it says, "These are the feasts of the Eternal, even holy convocations, holy gatherings, that you will proclaim in their seasons." And we've seen how this really is part of life. This is part of our physical existence. And in, you know, let's take the smallest unit. Let's take the day for a start and have a look at that, because our sleep is very important. Let's go and have a look at an example of Christ over in Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8. Here we find Christ as he, as a human being. Luke chapter 8 verse 22, it says, "Now it came to pass on a certain day that he went in a ship with his disciples, And he said to them, let us go over to the other side of the lake, and they launched forth. So here he was. He'd been busy all the day, and they launched forth, and presumably it was towards evening. I don't know. He was very tired. Anyway, he says, as they sailed, he fell asleep. And there came down a storm of wind on the lake, and they were filled with water, and they were in jeopardy. And they came to him and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we're perishing. But he was fast asleep in the ship at that time, in the boat at that time. And, you know, on the lakes, they can be. They can be quite rough. And if you've got an open boat or an open canoe, it can be quite rough on lakes. And certainly the Sea of Galilee, it would be, you know, it's broad enough there. Is it 20 miles across? I have to look it up. Maybe it's 10. No, I think it's about 20 miles both ways, I think. So it's a fairish size. It's called a sea. And I'd imagine that it could get quite choppy as you go into the middle of the lake. And but Christ was able to sleep even in something like that. Notice over in Luke chapter 6, you find here that although, yes, Christ slept, and he would have undoubtedly, remember, he didn't sin. He did not sin physically. And we need to understand that sleep, yes, we need to be able to sleep. We need to be able to sleep regularly, and the day and the night has been given to us to get into that rhythm of sleep. But if we were to miss a night's sleep, it is not a sin to do so. Notice what it says here in Luke chapter 6, in verse 12. It says, and it came to pass in those days that he went out into a mountain to pray, and he continued all night in prayer to God. So we see here that he prayed all night. It's not wrong for that to be the case, for us to occasionally miss a night's sleep. Certainly when we're travelling, we do not sleep the way we normally should. But if that continued over and over again, that we're missing sleep continually, then we're sinning against the body. You see, this was a unique situation in the way of for Christ, verse 13. And when it was day, he called to him his disciples, and of them he chose 12 that he named apostles. Now, these 12 apostles were the beginning of the very New Testament church, the beginning of the stage of God's plan to reproduce himself, of the very mind of God being reproduced within human beings, a vital stage. And, you know, it was not a normal time. He had to spend the time in prayer before his Father, and giving us an example of how to do that. We turn back to Ecclesiastes again. Ecclesiastes 5. We find a principle. If we have a problem sleeping, there is a principle here within Ecclesiastes 5, put here by God, that ties us back to the section on air and blood and getting the blood going around our bodies. But Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10, it says, he that loves silver won't be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they're increased that eat them. This is Ecclesiastes 5, verse 11. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving beholding of them with their eyes? In other words, is this really what life is all about? And it says, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich does not allow him to sleep. So we look here and we see that one way in which sleep is possible, if we're having difficulty sleeping, is the sleep of a labouring man. That in fact, if you get that air moving and get that air moving through our body and the blood moving through our body, that does help us to sleep. If we're busy and we're energetic and we ride our bike or whatever else we do, that in fact helps the process of sleep. And certainly if we are sitting down all the time, then there's certainly a problem that is there. I think we just had somebody at the door briefly. Anyway, whether it's carol singers or not, I'm not quite sure. Christmas present left at the door, right. Excuse us. There we go. I've got an article here regarding sleep. And just to reinforce, as I say, it is not wrong to go ahead and miss sleep very occasionally, But it is wrong to go ahead and to continually miss sleep, or to continually be out of rhythm. There's an article here that appeared in the Telegraph the beginning of this month, and it says, the shortage of sleep is linked to obesity. Now this is something which is quite interesting. It says, the less you sleep, the more your waist will expand, say scientists who have linked the insomniac lifestyle of Western society to the epidemic of obesity. Lack of sleep boosts levels of a hormone that trigger appetite and lowers levels of a hormone that tells your body it's full, according to the team. The scientists will now study whether obese people should sleep more to lose weight. Obviously, the indication is that they should. And it says, the study by Professor Migno of Stanford University and Dr. Tahari of the University of Bristol and colleagues is published today in the Public Library of Science. Quote, our results demonstrate an important relationship between sleep and metabolic hormones. It says, in Western societies, where chronic sleep restriction is common and food is widely available, changes in appetite, regulatory hormones with sleep curtailment may contribute to obesity. So I thought that was quite an interesting article. And if nothing else, it's one thing that we need to keep in mind regarding sleep, that we should be sleeping regularly, whether it's 8 hours or not, or whether it's only six you need, but certainly if you're getting less than six, you've probably got a major problem if you're doing that on a regular basis. So it's something to look at. There's also the Sabbath, which we've just read to some degree, where it was implemented. But the Sabbath is an area, I won't go into the Sabbath, I mean that's a subject by itself. What I will do is I'll just read one part from, what was this, the Good News of April 1980, the personal, where it's talking about how you are being tested, and it's talking about the Sabbath in that personal, and the area of testing that he's talking about is the Sabbath. But he mentions just one experience that he had regarding rest, quite frankly. It says, on the other hand, he says, God made the Sabbath to be a time of joy, of delight, of rest, prayer, contemplation, Bible study and worship. And he gives this example. He says, when I was 19 years of age, I was a timekeeper and paymaster in Southern Mississippi Lumber Mill. I had to do the job that three men had been required to do before I came. I worked one night until 10, the next night until midnight, 6 days and nights a week. I was overworked. In 6 months, I landed in the hospital with a severe case of typhoid fever. To just lie there in bed and rest was so delightful after 6 months' stint of 18-hour day labour. I realised as never before how delightful that rest from work can be. And it is. The indication is within Scripture that we should work, and we should be working 6 days shall you labour and do the work, but then you have the Sabbath. So there is a balance there between work and between rest, and we've been given that balance. We've got to make sure that we do. And so for instance, for ourselves, for my wife and myself, we've got to be very careful, because we can quite easily work 7 days a week, quite easily, and that we might do that for a short period of time, but if we do not take time off, then we can have some really major health problems if we're not careful. If you turn over to Mark chapter 6, you see that Christ and the apostles, or his disciples, they had this problem. And if we, within our modern world, again, there's a problem there, that sometimes we can work all week and then perhaps drive excessive distances on the Sabbath. We've got to be a little bit careful on that. And I'm not talking about, 10, 20, 30 miles. I'm talking about hundreds of miles. But we do that over here in the UK when we get together every month. We've got to do that, basically, to get everybody together. But we do need to be a little bit careful. But here in Mark chapter 6, notice in verse 30, it says, the apostles gathered themselves together to Jesus and told him all things. Now, this basically was just after John the Baptist had been beheaded. So the apostles gathered together and talked to Jesus about it. And they were under, obviously, a good deal of stress with the execution of John. Both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, come ye yourselves apart for a desert place for a rest a while, For there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as even to eat. So in other words, they were absolutely frantic with work. And Christ implemented this, and he said, look, get some time off. Take the time off. Now that doesn't mean to say we just lounge around all day by any stretch. It's when we are working to such an extent, as it says here, you don't have the time to stop and eat properly. If we are doing that, then we have got to take time off. We've got to have the relaxation. We've got to make that time. And I know that Judy and I talk about when we're travelling, and we are going to try, if we're going from place to place to place, which we may have to do this summer, we're going to have to put some days between the places so that we can, you know, we've done it before, we just simply get a hotel for a day, perhaps 2 days, and we just crash out for 2 days and we just basically do nothing for a couple of days, and then we can carry on. But if we just keep going and going and going, and you're journeying through time zones, it just wears you out. You just cannot function and you get ill. But it says here, and here, this was the problem that Christ was having. It says, look, there's so much toing and froing, and they hadn't leisure even to eat. So Christ said, look, let's go off by ourselves and just spend some time. And this is what Mr. Armstrong used to do. He used to take time off, because he was working 7 days a week, and he used to take the time off in order to do that. It's interesting, though, they departed into a desert place, verse 32, by ship privately. So they went away privately, quietly, by themselves. And the people saw them departed, and they also then went round, and when he saw much people, verse 34, and was moved with compassion towards them, because they were sheep having no shepherd, and began to teach them many things. So they never actually got to go somewhere quiet. Now, I want you to notice how also there is this principle of priorities and order and priorities within Christ's life here. Because in verse 45, notice, it says, well, verse 44, they did eat the loaves, were about 5,000 men. So he just had these loaves and fishes, he'd been teaching them. And verse 45, and straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida. And he went away, and then he sent away the people. So he stayed behind, dismissed the people, and saw them off. And the disciples then went off by boat. And then when they had sent them away, and this obviously must have been quite late, he departed into a mountain to pray. So even though they had been frantic, even though they had been worked to the bone, and even though he desired to get away and have that time, he then, you know, he had priorities. He had to look after the people there spiritually. But he also realized he had to pray. And so often we can get so frantically overworked that we don't pray. Look at the priorities that Christ had here, and notice the priorities and the essential qualities that he put into place. We also need to make sure we do get the priorities right. Relaxation is necessary, but you know, it comes even behind prayer. It comes behind prayer. I always remember the statement made that, you know, it's far better to fall asleep praying than fall asleep not praying. In other words, fall asleep not having prayed. But far better even than that is to get up in the morning and have a decent night's sleep and to go ahead and pray and have a schedule worked out in that regard. So time is part of life, just as much as food is, much as air and exercise and the blood moving around and the environment and the hygiene that is there. It's all part of our physical life, and each one impacts in the way that we are, the way that we live. And so we need to make sure that we get each in balance, and we get them in balance so that our physical life can be the way that God originally intended, at least within our constraints of our modern world. You know, we have constraints, but we are expected to put our physical life into balance to the best of our ability. The next areas I'll cover, and that'll be next time, not next Sabbath, because we'll be in Tennessee for next Sabbath, but in 3 weeks' time, will be the mind, the relationships, and also the subject of healing. That's the three areas that will then conclude this series of Bible studies on our personal health.